How do you look at life? I suppose you could divide people into two categories. That's often done. There are those who see the glass half full and those who see the glass half empty. Another way to say the same thing is some people are optimists and some people are pessimists. Now, that's critical because the way you look at life determines what you do. So that sounds like an incredibly simple thing, but in counseling with people, I've noted over and over again, their perception of what's going on isn't what's really going on, that they need to look at reality and see what's really there before they can make any progress on solving the problems that bother them. Now, I think that's true in life, and I think that's true in the spiritual life, that who you are and what you see determines what you do spiritually. And I think one of the great, great illustrations of that is in Numbers chapter 13. Of all the material in the book of Numbers, we are now coming upon probably the most well-known story. If I were to mention Numbers and say, tell me what you know about Numbers, the average Christian who sits in church would probably mention this event. So let's look at it. It's incredibly simple, and yet I think that simple truth is rather profound. The first part of the passage, matter of fact, the first 16 verses, are just a command that the Lord gives to Moses. Moses then, in turn, gives a commission to spies, and then we have their compliance with that commission. So I'm going to start with the command that the Lord gave to Moses. So look at verse 1. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, send men to spy out the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the children of Israel. From each tribe of their fathers you shall send a man, every one a leader among them. Now, this is the initial command. It is nothing more than the Lord sending out 12 spies, one from each of the 12 tribes. Now, you would never know this by looking at these three verses, but later in the book of Deuteronomy, we are told that the children of Israel requested that they be sent into the land as spies. Now that brings up, it seems to me, a critical issue. Is this rebellion on their part at this point? They're requesting spies rather than just saying, let's go. So I grapple with that question as I looked at just the command to send spies, knowing that Deuteronomy 1:22 said the children of Israel requested that they send spies. One commentator put it like this: when the people arrived at Kadesh, the Lord told them to go up and take possession of the land that he had promised them. That also is in Deuteronomy chapter 1. Instead of advancing into Canaan, the people asked Moses if they could send spies ahead of them. They did so, now I'm quoting Deuteronomy 1:22, that they may search out the land for us and bring back to us word of the way by which we should go up and the cities which we should enter, end of quote. Moses allowed this, but only with God's permission. So this commentator says, clearly the Israelites were not rebelling against God by sending the spies, but neither were they stepping forward in bold obedience with strong confidence in God as they should have done. So when you put these opening verses of Numbers 13 with Deuteronomy chapter 1, they request it. God says, okay, do it. And I'm not sure it's rebellion, but it's certainly not bold obedience either. At any rate, the plot thickens. The next verse simply tells us Moses did what the Lord told him to do. Verse 3 says, so the Lord sent them from the wilderness of Paran, according to the commandment of the Lord, all of them men who were heads of the children of Israel. This is simply saying that they had 12 spies from the 12 tribes. Now, verses 4 to 16 says, now these were the names, and I'm not going to bore you with all those names, except to point out that one of them is Michael. At any rate, the names of the 12 tribes and the leaders of each tribe and the fathers of the leaders. So there's just a pile of names between verses 4 and the first part of verse 16. Now, if you will recall, earlier in the book of Numbers, we had a list of names of the leaders of the tribes. This is a different list. The list given earlier were the heads of the tribes. These were the spies from each tribe, and apparently these men were chosen not because they were the head, but perhaps because of some other personal qualification. So there are two different lists from the 12 tribes, one given way back in chapter 1, and again in chapter 7, and now this one in chapter 13, but they are different, and this list is different. So the latter part of verse 16 says, and Moses called Hoshea, the son of Nun, Joshua. So how this gets in here, I'm not sure, but just Moses thought, let me tell you, I changed Joshua's name. His name originally was Hoshea, and that means, the Hebrew word means salvation. That's it, just salvation. He changed it to Joshua, and that means God is salvation. Now, why he did that is not entirely clear. But we do know this, that by renaming Joshua, he is pointing to the source of the salvation. His former name did not do that. But by naming him Joshua, it is God is salvation. God is the deliverer. And that is significant, I take it, though this isn't clearly spelled out in the text, because you're about to go into the land and you're going to spy it out. Just remember, I'm going to name one of the spies Joshua, that God is the deliverer. So these opening 16 verses are nothing more than God giving the command to Moses to send out the spies. The next several verses, verses 17 through 20, is Moses giving the commission to the spies. Verse 17, then Moses said to them to spy out the land of Canaan and say to them, go up this way into the south and go up to the mountains and see what the land is like, whether the people who dwell in it are strong or weak, few or many, whether the land they dwell in is good or bad, whether the cities they dwell in are like camps or strongholds, whether the land is rich or poor, and whether there are forests there or not. Wow. That is a pretty complete job description. Basically, it boils down to two things. Moses is telling Joshua, I'm telling the 12 spies, not just Joshua, I want you to go in the land and I want you to look basically at the people and I want you to look at the inhabitants. So you could divide everything that's said in Numbers 13, 17 through 20 into those two parts. Now, I want to talk about this for just a minute. Notice it says, go up this way into the south. All right? That in, if you look on a map, that'll be called the Negev. It's in the southern part, the real southern part of the land. It was like a desert. That's why it's called the Negev. And it formed a transition from the desert, sure enough, to the fertile fields of Canaan. I am told the average rainfall was between 8 and 12 inches per year in the south, what is being called the south here. Notice it's capitalized, making it semi-arid. In other words, this wasn't exactly the desert. It's the transition from the desert to the cultivated part of the land. It's semi-desert. And the rainfall makes me think of Los Angeles. Isn't that about the average rainfall we're supposed to have in Southern California? The hill country, or the mountains as it's called here, is still further north. So that is what you normally think of when you think of the land of Palestine. It includes Jerusalem. That's the part of the land that was eventually given to Judah and Ephraim. So they're down in the Sinai, and he's telling them to go north, but that's called the southern part of the land, and look at the mountains. That's the commission. Then he says to them in verse 20, the latter part of verse 20, be of good cheer and bring some fruit of the land. Now the time of the season was the first ripe grapes. Now we know that he gives us the time, and the time was when the grapes were ripe. We know that that was late July or early August. So it's about this time of the year. Okay? That's the commission. So God commands Moses to send out 12 spies. Moses commissions the 12 spies to go. The next part of the passage is their compliance. Look at verse 21. So they went up and spied out the land from the wilderness of Zin as far as Rehob, near the entrance of Hannah. Now, this is going to take a little bit of explanation. And I grappled with how to do that. And I thought this would be a great time to put a map up on a screen. Let me see if I can explain this by illustrating it. Let's suppose that you were in Mexico, down by Tijuana. And Moses said, I want you to go north. The first thing you're going to do is hit Southern California. But I want you to go all the way to Oregon. Now, that's a pretty good illustration of what's going on here. The South was north of where they were, and being in Mexico and going to Southern California is a good illustration of that. But the cities that are named here take you all the way to Lebanon, and Lebanon is north of the land of Palestine. So, and this, by the way, California and Oregon are not the same in proportion to the land. The land of Israel is no bigger than the state of New Jersey. But it gives you the geographical idea in outline form that they went to the southern part, and then they went all the way up to Lebanon, which was 100 miles north of the Sea of Galilee. So they really went through a lot of the land. Now, This took them 40 days, by the way, which he says later. Now, verse 21 simply says, they went up and they spied out the land, and gives us the whole parameter. Verse 22 backs down to the southern portion. So verse 21 says, go from Southern California to Oregon. Verse 22 says, and they went up through the south and came to Hebron, and then some other cities around Hebron are mentioned. They are insignificant. At the end of 22, he says, now Hebron was built 7 years before Zion in Egypt. Now, this is like saying they got as far as Southern California, and the most important city in Southern California was Los Angeles. In this case, the most important city in Hebron was, I'm sorry, in the southern part of Israel was Hebron. Now, why does he stop and emphasize that? He picks that out, even tells us that it was built 7 years before Zion in Egypt. What's that all about? Well, Zion is another name for the capital of Egypt, which is where they started from. And we know that Zion was built in 730 BC. So Hebron was built before that. Now, we also know that Hebron is a very important place. You know, most people don't know about Hebron. They know about Galilee and Jerusalem and Jericho and those kind of places, Samaria. But Hebron is a very important place, especially in the early part of Genesis. For example, it was in Hebron that God promised to give Abraham the land. That's in Genesis 13. It was out of Hebron that Abraham set out to defeat the coalition of kings in Genesis 14. It's the only piece of real estate that God gave to Abraham that he actually possessed, and he's buried there. As a matter of fact, I've been there, and the patriarchs are buried there, and it's controlled by the Muslims, and archaeologists can't dig down there, but Abraham and Sarah and a number of the others are buried in the same spot in Hebron. Later, when they entered the land, Caleb settled in Hebron. So this is a very significant place. And then even later than that, it became David's capital before he conquered Jerusalem and made it the capital. It's south of Jerusalem. Now, I'd like to suggest that we're going to rename Joshua. Got it? What's he? What does his name mean? I changed his name. What does it mean? God is the deliverer. God is deliverance. God is salvation. And then we're going to go to Hebron. Shouldn't that remind you? This is where God gave us the land. They knew that. This is where Abraham is buried. So in the spies are crossing these historical markers as they go through the land. So verse 23 says, then they came to the valley of Eshcol, and they cut down a branch with one cluster of grapes, and they carried it between two of them on a pole. They also brought some of the pomegranates and figs. The place was called the valley of Eshcol because the cluster which the men of Israel cut down there. Eshcol means cluster. Now, this is very interesting. Just imagine a cluster of grapes. The cluster was so big, they had to get a pole, hang the cluster on the pole, and then two men got on either end of the pole, and they carried the pole. The cluster of grapes was so big. It's just almost mind-boggling. But this becomes deeply significant. This, by the way, is just north of Hebron. It is still known for its grapes, but this becomes the symbol of Israel, as well as illustrating its great potential for agricultural productivity. It's the popular symbol of Israel till this day. If you go to Israel, you will see this symbol. Two men carrying a pole, and between them is this huge cluster of grapes. As a matter of fact, it's the logo for Israel's Department of Tourism. They are strangers in the land, so this is the logo. This becomes deeply significant. Now, he says in verse 25, they returned from spying out the land after 40 days. As I mentioned, the trip took 40 days. All right, so far I've mentioned three things. God gives a command to Moses. Secondly, Moses gives a commission to the spies. Thirdly, the spies comply and they go do what Moses commissioned them to do. Got it? Got it. Now they get back and they got to give a report. So, beginning in verse 26, we have the report that the spies gave to the people. It says in verse 26, now they departed and came back to Moses and Aaron and all the congregation of the children of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. They brought back word to them and all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. Then they told them and said, we went to the land where you sent us. It truly flows with milk and honey, and this is the fruit. Nevertheless, verse 28, the people who dwell in the land are strong. The cities are fortified and very large. Moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. And the Amalekites dwell in the land of the south. The Hittites, the Jebusites, and the Amorites dwelt in the mountains, and the Canaanites dwelt by the sea and along the banks of the Jordan. So here is the report. I mentioned that the commission consisted of two things. Go tell us about the land and tell us about the people. The report follows that outline. So in verse 26, they showed them the fruit. In verse 27, it says, here's the land. It flows with milk and honey, and here's an illustration. Here is the fruit. So they did what Moses told them to do. They gave a report concerning the land. But verse 28 says, well, now, nevertheless, the people, this is the second part of the report. Well, the people are strong. They're very large. And they have fortified cities. And furthermore, they're descendants of people who are known to be giants. That's the meaning of all this. So the complete report included all these various nationalities, people that dwelt in the land. But the basic idea here is the land is beautiful and bountiful, but the inhabitants are dangerous. Now, let me make just a comment or two. Verse 29 lists all these people that you hear about in the Bible. The Canaanites were the original indigenous inhabitants of the land. They were there longer than anybody else. The Amorites entered Canaan from Syria sometime before 2000 BC, and they drove the Canaanites out of the hill country and took their place. The Hittites originated from what we today would call central Turkey. They did that about 1800 BC, and they slowly spread south and southeast. The Jebusites are mentioned, and frankly, we do not know anything about their origin, except that they remained in control of Jerusalem until 400 years after Moses, when David drove them out and captured the city and made it his capital in 1004 BC. Now, the point is, all these other people came to this land. Why? Because it's so beautiful, because it's so productive. And the purpose of saying, of all these people being there, is they came in and conquered it. They're not going to give it up real easy. They fought to get it, and they're going to keep it. That seems to be the idea. Now, there was a minority report. Verse 30. Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, "Let us go up at once and take possession, for we are well able to overcome." Now, 10 of the 12 spies said, "It's a beautiful land. Here's a sample, the grapes. But let me tell you, we don't want to go there. We can't conquer that place." And Caleb says, "We can not only do it, let's do it immediately. Let's go up at once." Verse 33. But the men who had gone up with him said, "We're not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we." And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land that they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we had gone through as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants. And all the people whom we saw there are men of giant stature." Then we saw the giants, the descendants of Anakot, come from the giants. "And we are like the grasshoppers in their sight, and so we were in their sight." So their response, this is the majority report. Majority report is, these people are huge. They got fortified cities. We can't do this. By the way, I am amazed at all the years I've taught the Bible, how often I get to a passage and something happens that week that relates to the passage. This happens to me all the time. I don't always point out, but you'll hear me say recently, that happened to me today. A friend of mine's son passed away. It's a very sad story. He was almost 50 years old, but the son who passed away, but he had a very rare disease and it finally took his life. So they had a funeral. And because I knew the father, I went to the funeral just to support him. Then I went to the reception. And we're all sitting at a restaurant. And some of these people hadn't seen each other, I guess, in a while. And there was one lady at the table who had a picture of her grandson. And she was showing everybody this picture. And it came to me, and I looked at it, and the lady in the picture, the grandmother, was of average height, and the grandson looked like he was twice as tall as she was. It was just staggering. And I said, I just blurted out, "How tall is he?" And she said, 6'5". Now, you know what everybody's response is when they hear that, right? Does he play basketball? She said, "No, he plays baseball. He wants to play baseball." Then she said to me, "He's in the 8th grade. "What? He's 6'5" and he's in the 8th grade? I said, "How tall is his father?" She said, "He's 6'5". So there are giants in their lands and they still exist. I mean, that boy ought to be a basketball player and just station him under the basket. You can't do that, I know. At any rate, I was struck by the fact that he was so tall in the eighth grade. Where will he stop? Who knows? All right, the point is, as I mentioned just a minute ago, that these various people groups invaded the land, and to use his expression, they devoured the inheritance. All these various groups came in and conquered them. They were stronger than the original inhabitants of the land, and by comparison, we're just little bitty grasshoppers. As a matter of fact, that struck me today, because the fella that passed away had a disease, and he lived by himself, but in a home, and a number of people that had problems lived in this home together, and there were several midgets at the funeral. And I thought, wow, I'm gonna go teach Numbers 13 tonight. There's a 6'5" guy, and here are these little midgets. There were several of them at the reception. All right, that's the picture of what they had to say. Now, the same word that's used here of giants is used in Genesis chapter 6. Remember at the beginning of the flood, they said there were giants in the land? It's the same word. Now, the point is that the commission had been to view the land and report back what they saw. That was the commission, remember? What did they do? They not only told what they saw, but they told what they thought they could not do because of what they saw. That was not their job description, but that's what they did. Now, let me sum this up very simply. When at the command of the Lord, Moses commissioned 12 spies to survey the land, one man felt they could conquer the land immediately, but 10 believed that it was impossible for them to conquer the land. That's the sum of the story. It's a real simple little story. It's a story you learned in Sunday school. All right, I want to make a couple of observations. From the standpoint of the 10 spies, number one, they were right. Right? They were right. Matter of fact, one fellow said, centuries later, when the Assyrians invented siege warfare and used massive machinery and engineering corps to subdue walled cities, it took them years to conquer that land. So from the human point of view, Israel was faced with a formidable foe. They pessimistically maintained that the task of conquering the land was impossible because of unfavorable odds. Now, there's a sense in which they were right. That was a huge challenge, and it was beyond their human capacity to do it. Second observation. In another sense, the 10 spies were very, very wrong. So what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is they told what they saw, but they didn't tell the whole picture. What did they leave out of the picture? Several things they should have picked up along the way. God's promise to give them the land. They should have been reminded of that by going to Hebron. They should have been reminded of that by the fact that Moses changed Joshua's name, to the fact that God was going to do this. They left all of that out of the report. And in so doing, they didn't see the total picture. Now, if you put this story in the context of the book of Numbers, we've already seen how they despised God's provision. Remember, they didn't like the manna. They wanted the quail. Remember that story? They've already despised God's provision. And now the 10 spies are disbelieving God's promise that he would give them the land. They reckoned only on their natural ability and failed to consider God's supernatural ability. One author put it like this: the section of text teaches us important lessons about inadequacy and adequacy. The 10 spies who did not want Israel to enter the land felt inadequate. In this, they were being realistic. However, they should have comprehended or compensated for their feelings of personal inadequacy by reminding themselves of God's complete adequacy. God was teaching the Israelites a basic lesson of life, namely that the real power in the lives of God's people is God's. As we trust and obey him, he releases his power through us. We're never adequate in ourselves, but God empowers the obedient and trusting. Jesus taught his disciples this same lesson when he multiplied the loaves and the fishes, and he did it twice. End of quote. Jesus said, without me, you can do nothing. Paul said, I can do all things through Christ who gives me the strength. So when you look at the situation, the land, and the people, are you looking only at your ability to conquer your obstacles, or are you looking at the Lord's ability to make you adequate for the challenge? So, the report of the spies was factual. The land was fruitful, the cities were fortified, and the population was mixed. They all had the same facts. But Joshua and Caleb not only had the facts, they had faith. They had the faith that God had promised them the land, and that because God had promised them the land, they could take it. Someone has said, John Garner said, what he said about the political arena can be applied to the spiritual arena and the Christian walk. And I end with this quote: we are continually faced with a series of great opportunities, brilliantly disguised as insolvable problems. May I repeat that? We are continually faced with a series of great opportunities, brilliantly disguised as insolvable problems that are only solvable by the Lord. Father, thank you for this story, including it in your word. Such a simple story. But thank you for the reminder that realistically there are things that are impossible for us, but all things are possible with you. Thank you for that reminder. In Jesus' name, amen.